Hello, everybody. This is Alan Arnett, and welcome to another podcast and a blog on alanarnett.com. It is Sunday, April the 14th, 2024, and this is the weekend update for the Everest 2024 and the 8,000ers all across the Himalayas season. And we're going to start with not exactly great news. So it looks like that the icefall doctors are having a bit of difficulty in finding a route through the Khumbu icefall on the Nepal side. And at this point in the season, it's not that concerning, but if they don't find a way through it in this next week or so, then we may start to see some concerns about the schedule. But it all depends upon the weather. So it's way, way too early for anybody to get upset or concerned about this, especially families back home. This is pretty normal, as I outlined on the blog that is accompanying this podcast and this audio version of the blog. So let's look at what's happening. So first off, I think as I previously reported, that the winter of 2024 throughout Nepal, especially in the upper Himalaya, were it's very warm and also very low precipitation. And we wondered, speculated about what impact that would have on the mountain. And now we're beginning to see what that is. The mystery is being uncovered, if you will. So what the end result has been relative to the icefall, remember the Khumbu icefall starts when the Khumbu Glacier leaves the Western Khum right below Mount Lhotse and falls about 2,000 feet from 19,500 to 17,500. It's a river of frozen ice that is moving about a meter, about 3 feet a day, down about a 35, 45 degree slope. But it's not a free flowing river like you would think of a river. It moves in jerks because what's happening is the bottom of the icefall, the bottom of the glacier, it gets caught on the rock. And that provides friction while the upper part continues to move. As a result, you have these gaps that are created or crevasses. Also, you have a lot of ice that ends up being jumbled and caught up in all of this movement, this unsettled, uneven movement. So you have these giant seracs, these giant tubes of ice, the size of a house, the size of a building that may jut up 20, 30, 50, 60 feet out of the icefall. And they can just fall over at any time due to the movement. So it is a dangerous place to be. And the icefall doctors, a team of dedicated Sherpas, about six of them this year, they're absolute experts in navigating this. Some of them have been doing the icefall route fixing for a decade or more. So these guys are world-class experts and know exactly what they're doing. What they have to do, though, is that they've got to go through and they've got to find a safe passage through in order to put ladders across those crevasses and the thin nylon fixed rope, which marks the route and also provides a safety line for everybody, Sherpas and climbers alike. Because remember, this is the route that leads into the Western Khum, that leads into Camp 1 at the Lower Khum, Camp 2 at the Upper Khum, and then on to Camp 3 on the Lhotse face, and then eventually to the South Col and the summit. So if you can't get through the icefall, you're not going to climb on the Nepal side, at least right now, the way the route is set up. There's been some work by people like Mark Batard that's looking at trying to find an alternate route. And apparently, he's going to come back this year and continue his work on the climber's right up on Noopsi on the right-hand side of the icefall. And that's very technical. It's very rocky. It's almost like a via ferrata that you're going to have to be doing some very technical climbing. And most people think that's not going to be a viable route for the commercial aspects of climbing Everest. It might be okay for some people as an alternative, but probably for the mainstream Sherpas carrying varying goods up to Camp 2, 3 and above, oxygen bottles, tents, stoves, food, fuel, etc. They're looking for somewhere where they can move quick and fast and minimize the amount of technical climbing that they have to do, both for speed and for safety. The other concern is that, as we saw in 2014, that to the climber's left is the west shoulder of Everest, and that's where those hanging seracs have existed for as long as we've been looking at Everest. So, you know, whatever, since the early 1900s. And those seracs tend to release more so in warmer weather than in colder weather. And that's the reason that climbers will go through the icefall, leaving base camp around 2 or 3 a.m. And hopefully they're at the top of the icefall by the time the sun hits those seracs, and that causes them to heat up and then to sliver off. Now, sliver is a relative term because it may be, this, again, the size of a house big old ice cube that falls onto the ice fall. And as we saw tragically in 2014, that exact scenario occurred, taking 16 lives. So the ice fall doctors are cognizant. They're very educated, very aware of all of these dangers. And what they've been doing for, well, since almost 2 weeks now, going on approaching three, is trying to find a way, a safe passage through the ice fall. It's complicated by a couple of things. One is that because of the low snow year, the glacier, the Khumbu Glacier, continues to thin, not necessarily receding, but it's thinning. And that's creating a lot more variation in the ice and the texture of the ice and the amount of crevasses and the number of seracs that are sticking out of it. Maybe seracs not the right term, but towers, ice towers. And there's one in particular that they're very concerned about, according to Garrett Madison. I was able to communicate with Garrett this morning, Sunday morning, April the 14th, and he gave me a really good update. So appreciate you, Garrett, very much. Basically, again, I'll put this chart up on this YouTube video. Those of you listening to this as an audio podcast obviously can't see it, but it's on my blog at alanarnett.com. You can easily find it. That it shows a black line that hugs the right-hand side of the Khumbu Icefall, the climber's right towards Noobsee, and it kind of abruptly stops in the middle. This is really far to the right than it has been in previous years. Typically, it goes pretty much dead center. 10 years ago, it used to go over to the left, hugging the left shoulder over by the west shoulder. But then that disaster occurred in 2014. So they began migrating it more to the right, to the climber's right, towards Noobsee. So this year, you know, they're just having a hard time finding a spot to go through it. Garrett says that they're going to regroup and try to the other side, the climber's left, closer to the west shoulder. He notes that this is where the route used to go 10 or 15 years ago, and they continue to be worried about that leaning tower, and they're hoping that it'll collapse before they get back in it and continue work. They may wait a few days out of safety, which is completely understandable and completely appropriate. You know, at this point in the season, there's not a lot of rush. It's a long season. If you look at the overall schedule of what most teams do, they arrive about now, around April 15th, tax day in the U.S. Hey, happy tax day, everybody in the U.S. But they arrive and they spend a few days just to rest up from the trek. Some of them did an acclimatization rotation over on Mira Peak, Island Peak, more often Lobachay, 20,000 foot trekking peak. I'll mention that in a second. And so they're going to rest up a few days. And then climbing Sherpas typically set up an obstacle course, if you will, right there next to base camp. Basically, they put a ladder across a gap, and they have some lines hanging off of some fairly steep ice walls. And so everybody there gets a chance to refresh skills on cramponing techniques and Jumar techniques and things, and crossing ladders. And for many people, this is the first time they've ever crossed a ladder in crampons and big old 8,000 meter boots. You know, this is not impossible, but yeah, it can be tricky. And you got to figure it out for the first time for yourself as to, you know, what's the right way. Do you put the middle of your foot in the middle of the ladder rung, or do you let your front point of the crampons go on one rung and the back points on the other rung? It all depends on how long your foot is. So, and you know, you figure all that out on the fly, and you figure all that out as you go through the ice fall multiple times. So there's going to be about a week of downtime, of refresher time, of rest time before the teams go up. Typically, they'll go up halfway into the ice fall. It's like a dress rehearsal, if you will. They'll wake up in the middle of the night. They'll have breakfast, a piece of toast, maybe an egg, some Senka coffee. That'll get your juices going, won't it? And so then they're going to go up through the ice fall, probably to the football field. It's kind of a flattish area. Who knows what it's like this year, if the football field even exists with the shape of the ice fall. But they'll go up there and tag it and come on back down to base camp and call it good for the day. That way you kind of get a little bit of a feeling for how the ice fall is going to be, how your body is reacting now to getting, you know, above 18,000 feet, maybe 18,500 at the most. You've been to 20, hopefully, on something like Island or Lobachay. So hopefully your body's kind of accustomed to this. But this is all the process of acclimatization over a multi-week period. Even those people that have acclimatized at home, it is not a substitute for the real world. Yes, absolutely. Using these altitude tents, the hypoxico training is valid and it works. But at the end of the day, you still got to get your body up through that. And your body still has to adjust the blood pH, and all the blood chemistry has to change. A lot of it, those people that are pre-acclimatized have a head start, but they've still got to do some work before they get up to, 29,000 feet, if you will. So anyway, but we're way ahead of ourselves. at this point, we got to get through the ice fall, and that's what they've got to do. So I think what's kind of going to be maybe unique about this year is that the latest in modern history, let's say since 2000 or so, that the route has not been through the ice fall was April 16th in 2010. So we've got 2 days to get to April 16th. Otherwise, now we're going to be embarking on new territory where the ice fall is not, quote unquote, in. The route's not fixed. In other words, they don't have the ladders and the nylon fixed rope set through the ice fall into the coom. It'll be the latest in modern history. So we'll see how it goes. Again, the ice fall doctors are just fantastic. They're highly skilled. They're highly motivated. And I know that they are working as hard as they can, and all the teams are going to have to be patient and just enjoy their vacation at Everest Base Camp for a week or so. And we'll see how long that that vacation goes. Hey, there's also been summits this year. Over on Annapurna, we've had the one of the first summits, but surprisingly, the first summit of an 8,000er this year occurred on Makalu. It occurred by the rope team from Pioneer. I may have gotten that confused. One of the Seven Summits Director Pioneer, nonetheless, the ropes made it to the top of Makalu and to Annapurna. And that was followed quickly by a lot of quote-unquote client success on Annapurna. One in particular, Ali Pepper out of Australia. Hey, congratulations to her. She got it. She's 48 years old, and she's on a quest to get all of the 14 8,000ers without using supplemental oxygen. And this was her third 14, so she's only got 11 more to go. Hey, another notable one to point out and send a huge shout out to is Nima Rinji. He's 17 years old. And he's also on track to summit all of the 8,000 meter mountains without supplemental oxygen. He was part of the rope fixing team on Annapurna, and he got his 11th 8,000 meter mountain. So the 17 year old only needs three more to become the youngest person to knock them all off. So super, super congratulations to him. Really, really well done. There were probably close to 20 or maybe 25 summits on Annapurna. My good friend, Phil Crampton with Altitude Junkies, he got his team up there as well. Haven't heard any details on that. So we'll see more what happens. All right. That was last week. Looking forward next week. Of course, all eyes are going to be in that ice fall, the ice fall doctors, sending the best wishes as well. And I'm 100% confident they will solve this Rubik's Cube, quite literally and figuratively of the ice fall. We're going to see a lot more summits on mountains like Makalu and Annapurna. Amina Blom, they got the rope set to the top of that beautiful, beautiful pointy peak. And so we're going to see a lot of summits on it. I think there's 66 permits that have been issued for Amina Blom. You know, teams are pulling into Everest Base Camp now, Adventure Consultants, International Mountain Guides, a lot of other ones, Adventures Ascents and others. They're all arriving, and they're going to be doing their puja this upcoming week. And I'll do another podcast about the puja later on this week. Let's see what else coming up this next week. We got to see the puja. I'm going to also point out a couple of what I think are notable attempts this year. And in my book, and I know not everybody agrees with this, because you know, you talk about the commercialization of Everest. And by the way, if you didn't watch the podcast with Will Cockrell on his book, Everest Inc., that I did with him a few days ago, take an hour and listen to this. If you're an Everest historian or interested in the history of Everest or just the commercialization of mountaineering, I think you'll be really, really surprised and informed by a lot of information that Will shares with us in the research of writing this book. It's an outstanding work, and I highly recommend the book, Everest Inc., Will Cockrell. Again, it's on my website, and you can go listen to the podcast. But one of the things we talked about was a number of people that climb without using supplemental oxygen. Of the close to 12,000 summits of oxygen by about 6,600 people, so 12,000 summits by 6,600 people, roughly two for one, but it's mostly Sherpas, obviously, Sherpas who have 5, 10, 15, 20, that kind of pads the number, if you will. But only 224 of those 12,000 were done without using supplemental oxygen. So in other words, 224 did not use supplemental oxygen to summit, only about 2%. So it's really a rarity to climb Mount Everest these days. And as has been widely noted, almost all the 8,000 meter mountains these days, people are using supplemental oxygen on, all the way from the lowest to the highest. So, you know, it's just a fact of the way the mountain is climbed these days. And I know a lot of people decry it for skill or for style and, you know, and the pure aspect of it. And they call it cheating, and to each his own. I'm not going to get pulled into that argument, but we got a few people trying this year to climb without, and I'm going to do a horrible job in pronouncing these names. Valerie Babinov, he's 59 years old. He's from Russia. He's a mountain guide, professional mountain glide. This guy is, he is the real deal. He won the Oscar of mountaineering, the Pilot d'Or in 2001 for his first attempt on Meru Shark Fin. A lot of you are familiar with that from some of the Jimmy Chin and Conrad Anker film, and another couple of routes that he's done. But if successful, Valerie would become the first, he would become the oldest person to summit Everest without using supplemental oxygen. Another person trying to kind of make some history for his country, the Bolivian Hugo Aravira. Sorry about that, Hugo. I can pronounce Hugo. Anyway, at age 45 from Bolivia, he's going to try to do Everest, then Lhotse, both without using supplemental oxygen. He's got a good track record. He's climbed Broad Peak and K2 without O's, so he knows what he's getting into. Also, Norwegian endurance athlete Frank Loki. He's 44 years old. He's going to try it without O's, as is Turkish climber Tunç Fındık. I know Tunç very well. He's 52 years old, and he has already completed all the 8,000 meter mountains, but now he wants to go back and get Everest without O's. He summited it twice with O's, and now he's going to try to get another one. Hey, another notable one I want to be watching carefully is my friend, Kamirita Sherpa. We were on K2 together, and he was instrumental in helping me to summit K2 along with Kami out of Pingboche. But Kamirita Sherpa, Kamirita has the record for the most summits of Everest at 29. And he was, he's going now for his 30th, probably 31st, because often he'll summit twice in the season, one working with a rope fixing team above Camp 2, then a Wells guiding clients, primarily for some of the Nepali companies right now, most often Seven Summits Treks or 8K, not 8K, 14K, people like that. Nonetheless, Kamirita, just a super strong climber, super nice human being. I was doing some research on him, and I've got this on the website of the blog, but his first summit was in 1970 with an Alpine Ascents team. And there were some really notable names on that particular expedition. Todd Burleson, who of course is the founder of Alpine Ascents, AAI. Pete Athens, who was in the day was known as Mr. Everest. Paul Morrow, Jeff Lakes, Graham Kerr, Dieter Fischbeck. Just a lot of really, really excellent names, people that went on to become legends in our industry. I've got some really nice quotes that I pulled from the Himalayan database about that particular expedition back in 1994. So a lot of history going on there, a lot of history this week between Will's book and then this. I guess I'm going down memory lane a little bit. So one final comment, and that is on the permits. And it's kind of interesting what's going on right now. So there is something going on that is not matching up with what I thought was going to happen. I was expecting this year to be a record breaker, breaking the number of Everest permits that were issued last year. So in 2023, there were 478 permits issued to climb Everest. That was an all-time record. This year, to date, as of April 10th, which is the latest numbers we have from the Nepal Ministry of Tourism, is down. Everest permits are down 34%. So this time last year, they had issued 319. This year, they've only issued 209. So down 34%, 319 to 209, down 34%. What's going on? I don't really know. I was expecting it to be a big year because of the permit price going from $11,000 to $15,000. Last year, there were 18 deaths. paradoxically, historically, whenever there's been a big death year, the following year has been a record year. This year may break that trend. It could be that too many people saw too many people dying on a mountain. And by my count, 11 of those 18 Everest climber deaths in 2023 were avoidable, were preventable, 11 of the 18. So maybe the community is looking at that and thinking hard about climbing Everest and realizing that you can lose your life climbing this mountain. You know, if you look at it, there's some real correlations between how much money you paid, regardless of the nationality of the operator versus those people who died. You know, there's the issue of inexperience continues to come up. So maybe the system is finally moving into a self-correcting scenario. I certainly hope so. I don't want to see one person lose their life on any mountain. It's too much of a sport that brings you home with great joy and satisfaction, and in my opinion, a better version of yourself for the suffering that you went through. So I'm hoping everybody this season will have a great season. And, you know, frankly, if we don't pop 300 permits on the Nepal side, many, many people will be very happy with that. Probably not the Nepal Ministry of Tourism, which is counting on that 11,000 per pop for royalty revenue and padding the coffers of the government, and also for the operators that don't quite have as many people as normal. But all in all, I think it's best for the mountain. I think it's best for the climbers. And honestly, I think it's best for the operators as well to operate within their limits and their capacity. But we'll see what happens. It's still really, really early. We've got, you know, the season won't end until late May. So we've got 6 weeks to go. And we're starting off a little bit unusual this year. And we'll just have to watch it closely. And I will be watching it closely. And I will be reporting closely, along with my fictional series, Everyday Everest. I'm getting a lot of positive feedback on that. So thank you all for your kind comments, and even for a few unkind comments. Appreciate everybody weighing in and letting me know what they think about that, as well as my usual coverage. So that's it for this weekend update on April 14th, 2024. This is Alan. Remember, memories are everything. Climb on.